This is Circulating Ideas. I'm Steve Thomas. My guest today is Allison Macrina. She's a librarian, privacy rights activist, and the founder and director of the Library Freedom Project. You can find her on Twitter at FlexLibris. Allison, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
I think a lot of people who are aware of you already know what your current passions are and stuff, but I was wondering what led you to librarianship in the first place?
I don't know that I was ever going to be very good at anything else. but truly, you know, I think like I don't remember when I first got the idea that that's what I wanted to do, because it was relatively early enough in my life that it feels like it's just been forever. But you know, I felt like the kind of like, Lloyd Dobler Say Anything, where you're like, I don't want to buy anything that's bought, made or sold. I don't want to make anything that's sold. You know what I'm talking about? That line from Say Anything.
Yeah.
Anyway, I didn't want a job where I was exploiting anyone, or I wanted to be relatively unexploited myself. I wanted to work with other people who were curious and critical thinkers. I wanted to do something in the public interest. And I've always been like a book person. So it just sort of seemed like the right thing. And then the politics of it, I think, were revealed to me later. And so I was just like, that's it. There's nothing else that I could possibly do other than this.
Can you talk about how you first started to think more concretely about the Library Freedom Project and kind of tell listeners kind of what that is once you get to that?
Totally. Point. So I was an IT librarian in Watertown, Massachusetts, at the Watertown Free Public Library. And I had always had like a very politically minded philosophy of libraries. The sort of traditional librarianship values of privacy and intellectual freedom and all that stuff were really paramount to me. But I guess one thing I always struggled with was like how to make them practical when you're thinking about your sort of day-to-day whatever. And so I was working as an IT librarian, and this was, you know, 2013, and something really big happened in the world. And of course, that is that the Edward Snowden revealed what he knew about NSA mass surveillance, and things sort of spun out from there. And from the Snowden stuff, I think I had been thinking about privacy and surveillance just as like an interested and curious person. But what changed for me with Snowden was that I realized that the scale of the problem was much bigger than I had thought. And I think many people thought this. And I started thinking, you know, this is not just a problem for an ostensibly free democratic society, which, sidebar, I don't really think we live in, but I think we should, and any further threats to it are like worse and worse. And I thought, you know, maybe this is an opportunity for librarians to really do something, or for me as a librarian to really do something, because this is so deeply connected with what our mission is. You know, you can't have intellectual freedom when you also have unlawful, overbroad government and corporate surveillance, because if you feel like you're being watched, you're not going to read, write, research, and speak freely. So I started thinking about this at Watertown, but I wasn't really sure what I wanted to do. And I decided that maybe I should, I did two things. I started teaching a computer security class, a computer privacy class at the library. And then I reached out to Radical Reference and I said, you know, do folks here want to get involved with me doing like some kind of direct action? You know, we can maybe do something, a more traditional direct action. Like, wouldn't it be cool if we did like a banner drop, like librarians reject mass surveillance, drop it over the side of a highway somewhere? Or maybe we could do something a little bit more practical and have a resource guide or something like that. So the computer security class, to my surprise, was like hugely popular. And then I should say also simultaneously, I had been getting questions from the patrons about privacy. And one thing that did kind of catalyze it for me that summer, around the time that I decided to start teaching these classes, was my good friend Cade Crockford, who works for the ACLU of Massachusetts, came to the library to do like a town hall type forum about privacy. And it was totally packed. It was like one of these programs, you know how we always have like the programs where we're like, we really are excited about this, but maybe no one's going to show up. This program, so right. And like, you just have to like make peace with that. So many people came. They were, you know, the emotions in the room were very volatile. People were deeply upset by what they had been learning about from Snowden, excuse me. And I think what was really revelatory to me was not just the amount of interest, but how much people wanted something really tangible to do next, like to protect themselves. And so I was like, okay, well, I feel like there's a moment here. So I started teaching this class, and it immediately was going really well. And then I got, you know, the RadRef people on. And what we ended up doing over the course of the next few months, we created a zine. It's called We Are All Suspects. I don't recommend people read that zine now because technology zines go out of date by the time you Xerox them. But we basically tried to give some resources, you know, a little bit of what the problem is, a little bit of like a know your rights guide, like here's what the ACLU, excuse me, and the NLG say about, you know, your right to privacy. And then some of the technology you can use to either minimize the data collected about you or obfuscate it. So we made that zine, and also people were really into it. And so it became apparent to me, all of this stuff was kind of snowballing, and I knew I had to do something bigger than that. So I got back in touch with my friend at the ACLU, and I said, hey, buddy, maybe we should have a train the trainers type thing for librarians. And this was, by then it's like spring of 2014. We had a very cold winter in Boston that year. Last year we had a lot of snow. The year before it was like deeply frigid and not a lot of work got done. So there was a little bit of lull in the timeline. So Kate and I, along with Jesse Rossman, who is a staff attorney at the ACLU of Massachusetts, we got together and we created this workshop. Which is more or less the form that we teach still now. We've expanded and we do some other more advanced things too. But our basic training is as follows. Cade will do kind of a background on major government surveillance programs, some of the intersections of corporate surveillance, and I think more specifically and more relevant for us as people who work in the public service, what does this mean for our patrons and who does it really affect? So they're recognizing that government mass surveillance is criminal no matter what, but it's especially awful because it is of a piece of some bigger injustices that a lot of us in libraries, more progressively minded or radically minded people are fighting all the time. And that is like, you know, the, racist policing of black and brown people, the Islamophobic, the racialization of Islam, and the racist targeting of Muslim people and people who are perceived to be Muslim. That's the whole racialization thing. You don't even have to be Muslim to be treated with systemic racism. Right. So recognizing surveillance is of a part of those other injustices, because those are the people who are under more surveillance now. They've been under more surveillance historically. So Cade kind of sets all that up. And then Jesse does the Know Your Rights training, what to do if you what your privacy rights are. And also, I should say, we work with the ACLU in each state now. We try to tailor it to state-specific legislation because data privacy laws in each state can be so wildly different. So, but we started with Jessie, and she you know, we'll talk about some of our rights, like under the Constitution, and then kind of what that means at the state level, and then what's happening in the courts right now, what we should be aware of. And then some like real life scenarios to be prepared for, like what to do if you get a national security letter. And of course, we know that this has happened in libraries before. We know of at least one big case, the Connecticut Four in 2005, who challenged the constitutionality of the gag order. National security letters being an information request that comes with an attached gag. So you have to give up information about your patrons to a rubber stamp court, or sometimes not even a court. But you're not allowed to tell anyone you got it. So this is a reasonably very frightening prospect. This is one of the things that has come around in the surveillance state. It wasn't new in the Patriot Act, but it was codified into the Patriot Act in a different way. I think it's section 550 or 515 or something that NSLs are in there. And so, you know, giving librarians some concrete idea of what the gag means, who it applies to, what you can do if you get one of these. For example, like, it doesn't say on the letter, you're allowed to call your attorney. And you are. Of course you are. But, you know, if you receive one of these things, it can be extremely frightening. You don't know what you're supposed to do. So Jesse kind of like lays all that out. And then I do the tech side of it. And I focus on free and open source software that can be installed on library computers or taught to patrons in computer classes or one-on-one tech help sessions. It can be embedded into existing computer literacy or info literacy, or it can be a standalone thing. Anyway, we started doing that back in, you know, spring, summer of 2014, and like it kind of blew up. Everybody in Massachusetts wanted to get themselves a library privacy workshop. And then we did that for a while. It was awesome. And then that September, we applied for some pretty substantial funding from the Knight Foundation. And we got it. And so this year, we were funded in February. So since around the beginning of this year, Library Freedom Project has been like a full-time nationwide and increasingly international gig. And now we teach more advanced privacy trainings. We work very closely with organizations like Tor Project and Electronic Frontier Foundation and Free Software Foundation and all these other cool technologists and law reform, impact litigation operations and activists and, of course, librarians. So, yeah, that's basically it.
No, that's awesome. One of the pushbacks I know a lot of people have, more specifically to the Tor relay thing, which we'll talk about a little bit later, but just that whole, you're hiding yourself from the government, and the government will say that, oh, you're facilitating criminal elements and everything. But a lot of this is also you're protecting yourself from criminal elements as well. You're protecting yourself from the government maybe, but you're also protecting yourself from getting scammed and things like that. So that's
what I say to people often when they give me an argument like that is I'm like, look, even if you think that surveillance has a positive relationship to fighting terrorism, which it absolutely doesn't, it's been demonstrated over and over again, but that you should use tools to minimize and obfuscate the amount of data that's discoverable about you, because the web is such an insecure place and because the intelligence agencies are actually actively making you less secure in their methods. Like, one thing that I bring up all the time is how the FBI director, James Comey, has been lobbying before Congress because he wants to get backdoors put into software. He wants American software companies to be required to give the government special access. But here's the thing about a backdoor. If you put a hole in a piece of software, you can't say that just the government is going to be able to scurry through that hole.
Right.
Anyone can get in there. So, you know, the FBI is actively working to make you less secure online. So that's why you should care about this as a sort of bigger thing for computer security.
And have you been heartened by the response that you've gotten from the librarian community? I mean, do you feel like I know there's been certainly pockets of support. Do you feel like the whole profession is embracing what you're doing, or do you feel like there's still resistance from people? Because it seems like we're kind of a weird profession in that there are really progressive people, but then there are also really conservative people who want to just keep doing the same thing we've always been doing.
Yeah. You know, I gotta say, so I am overwhelmed by the support we got. I mean, I never, when I got started this, I thought this is probably a good idea. I didn't realize that it was something that people wanted and also really needed. And we truly cannot keep up with the demand. I mean, I am wearing myself pretty thin trying to go to all these places, and we're certainly looking for more funding to try to meet that. We set the goal for the first year for Knight Foundation that we would try to visit 40 libraries in our year one plan. If I don't add any more, and that is not going to happen, but if I just like stop now in booking more for before February, which would be the end of year one, we'll have 65.
Wow.
And that's not even like, you know, webinars and things of that nature. And like, and also the kind of like ripple effect that this has had, where many people who have taken our trainings have then gone on to do their own stuff. So yeah, the interest, like I have to say, I'm kind of in a bubble of Library Freedom Project. So like, I don't know if what I'm seeing is like, there's some kind of like librarianship institutional, or like, there's like some dynamic shift happening like at some top level. But what I can say is that there are at least many, many, many librarians who are interested in this, who want us to come and do trainings for them and want to know how they can get more involved. As for the haters, they're conspicuous in their silence, right? Like I never hear from them. I would love to. Please tell me if you have criticism. I think that that might be like kind of a, like, not to, you know, go into like the librarian stereotype, but I do kind of feel like some of the more conservative elements of the profession, like they're like maybe grumbling to themselves quietly in a room somewhere, and I will never hear their complaints. I'm not really mad at that. We do love hearing feedback, negative and positive, because it helps us get better. But I really have not heard from maybe like one or two people who, most of the criticism I've heard is not, this is not something you should be doing, but it's the sort of criticism that activists get all the time, where it's like some person in totally bad faith will say like, oh, the whole system is screwed anyway, so why even bother? And like, usually that person is doing nothing to fix whatever the inherent rottenness of the system is. So like, I hear stuff like that sometimes, but that criticism is meaningless.
And you've talked about this a little bit. How important do you think it is that librarians, I think that's sort of your goal overall, is to not that you do all these trainings all over the world, but you want to do that train the trainer kind of thing and get people learning how to train their own people. So how important do you think it is that we need to get patrons involved and educated on these issues?
Oh, it's like the whole point of Library Freedom Project. I mean, basically what my goal in every one of these trainings is, you know, let's say there's 50 people in the room. Well, probably, you know, 30 of them at least will go home and download a few of the tools that I recommend and use them on their own. And like, maybe, you know, also like some of them will just like tack up our little legal how-to guide next to the reference desk, and like, that'll be the extent of it. And that's great. Like, that's still, they're doing something good for themselves. The next tier, like another, you know, 15 of them will start to talk to other librarians that they work with or with their administration and think about how they can do whatever the next step that really appealed to them is. And that sometimes is, we've heard from a lot of folks who have started teaching computer privacy classes, and we offer resources on Library Freedom Project website, slides and a teacher's guide and just the basic stuff if you want to use that on your own. And it's all Creative Commons license, like you can just take it. Some of the people will want to teach these classes. Some of the people want to install things directly on the computers, and that's sort of the thing that they start working on. Some of them take an even different route where they're blogging about privacy and intellectual freedom and the relationship to technology and library tech. And so Yeah, I mean, I think that what's been really inspiring is that like people have taken this in so many directions and they really are taking action immediately. What I would love to see is more, of course, direct involvement with teaching patrons this stuff. Right now, the way that that's kind of gone down is a lot of times folks will invite us to do a training and then they'll have us do a class for patrons also. Like we'll do the whole thing with the ACLU. And then I'll stick around and I'll do like a 2-hour class for computer privacy for the public. And, you know, those are great because then the librarians can observe them and they can sort of get some idea of how I teach these. But what I would really love to do going forward is to do less of those because the librarians themselves are doing them. And I think, you know, that's just going to come with time. I mean, it's still a really new project. And this material is really, really most of the stuff, the people in our audiences, they're really sympathetic to it and they want to learn, but they've never heard of any of it before. So, you know, I think we've made a lot of progress in at least like as a professional development education initiative. And then the next thing will be more taking it to the public.
Do you have any sense of how well this topic is covered in library schools? I mean, I can say I'm old and went to library school 15 years ago, so they didn't really cover much of that back then, but do you feel like it is covered at all, or is that part of, could you see that as part of the mission of the project eventually getting into that of helping educate library school educators, so educating the educator?
Yeah, so I think that your audience probably is like laughing because everyone's like, oh, what does library school even teach? I mean, I don't know. Who had a good library school experience among us? I don't know anybody who did.
15 years ago, but we were still doing command line dialogue back then. So,
and we were too. I graduated in 2008.
Yeah.
And the thing is, like, some of that was like really interesting, but like, was it useful? No. I think that this fits with like a much bigger critique of library school content and like how it bizarrely prioritizes management courses when like most of us in the profession are women and will never be managers. And plus, like, that's just like a stupid, like, I learned Six Sigma in my library school, and I like resented it so hard. And I went to class every day angry because I was like, this is something that gets made fun of on 30 Rock. I can't believe I have to learn it in my graduate program. All that said, one of the things that has been really like one of my favorite groups to talk to, and I love talking to all librarians. No one get offended by this, but I really love talking to library science students because they're not getting this in their classes and they're really desperate for it. And they're also, you know how they are, like they're more ideological. They're sort of more, they haven't been like beaten down by like the some of the problems in our profession yet. And they're much more willing to take chances. So that I think makes me feel optimistic about the possibility for making some changes within library school curriculum. Also, there are pockets. I mean, I had some really awesome professors in library school. I don't want to denigrate them at all. It's the system, the curriculum development and all the ways that they have the school set up is the problem. So a lot of really awesome professors here and there have contacted me. For example, I'm going to Urbana in November, and I'm going to do a guest lecture spot for one of the classes there. I have been in touch with some other library schools about doing the same kind of thing, or maybe even doing a more developed class. And I think that it's just going to sort of seep into library school. I'm not holding my breath about like major institutional change, but we're certainly getting in there.
I mean, cause that's really the way, like you said, that's the, you want to catch them when they're young and still have that before they're jaded by life and still waiting for all those retirements of those old librarians.
they've been telling that lie for like 2 decades.
So you guys, you have 2 kind of really big projects going, but before we get into that, I want to ask real quickly about the Digital Rights in Libraries conference that you did after ALA. How did you decide to come up with that, and how did you get that all planned out?
So the way I came up with that, God, I'm going to sound like so cynical to everybody. I'm actually like really a happy-go-lucky person, but the way I came up with digital rights and libraries was I wanted to do some presentations at ALA, and I was like stymied at every turn that like they were like, you know, oh, you have to have your you have to have had your proposal and your blood oath in 18 months prior to the conference, and like if you didn't say the correct incantation to summon the troll who like will then ask you like the further riddle questions, like I just didn't do it right somehow, and the bureaucracy of getting into ALA's conference, like it was the first time I had ever tried to get in, and I was like pretty shocked and appalled by how difficult they make it, and I couldn't get a group to like everybody's group had already sort of sponsored things and you know they had like I don't know, like probably couldn't fit me in among like the 20,000 makerspace presentations. And so I did end up talking at ALA, and I probably, God, they probably will never let me talk in there again now that I've made fun of them. But I did have a great presentation with Blake Carver from Lyrisys, which was awesome. But I only got in because he had already submitted his stuff like in the 18 month prior thing that you're supposed to, or Lyrisys had. So for an individual who doesn't
it sounded like you were going to say he had submitted it back in the 1800s, but
basically, yeah. I mean, you as an individual, it seems like preposterously difficult to get a good program set up at ALA. Like you have to have the kind of institutional backing, and like I didn't have that yet. So I was really stymied by it. So I was like, you know what? I'm just going to do my own thing, and I'm going to have a conference where folks who are already at ALA, you know, no one's going to have to buy another plane ticket. They can come to this conference, and it's going to represent a lot of the things that I wish that ALA would support more of. And that is like specific topics, you know, obviously it was around digital rights. We covered privacy, access, censorship, copyright, you know, and some of the more kind of human elements of those things, like how this fits in with the intersections of race and class and gender, and like a bigger kind of criticism of like neoliberalism, essentially, I guess. I also really wish ALA would do a better job of getting thought leaders from other from different realms other than librarianship. So I started planning this with my friend April Glazer, who at the time was working for the Electronic Frontier Foundation, and is no longer. She's now with Greenpeace. Actually, sorry, she was with the EFF Ed. She's now with Greenpeace. And we just reached out to a bunch of our friends and people that we thought were cool and said, hey, do you want to come and speak at this conference? And everyone said yes. And we decided to have it at Noisebridge, which is a pretty well-known, iconic anarchist hackerspace in the Mission. And like, it couldn't have been more different. It was like, if you went to the Moscone Center, that's like, you know, like industrial carpeting and like fluorescent lighting and like super conference center hell. Noisebridge is like a crusty, like there, one of the bathrooms wasn't working. Like everything is like sort of like in like a beautiful disarray. Like it's like a bunch of rolling chairs that have been like trash picked from places. I mean, it really is exactly what you think. It's also amazing, and they do really incredible work at Noisebridge, and I wanted to have it at this special place. So we had it, and we got some folks from really cool organizations. Brewster Kahle from Internet Archive spoke. Sarah Houghton, the librarian in Black, spoke. We had people from Creative Commons. EFF, of course, like we had like half their staff there. We had people from The Intercept. We had people from Arab Resource Organizing Committee, from Hack the Hood. Like it was just this amazing representation of like all these different people in activism and technology and librarianship and law. And we got probably like 250 people over the course of the 2 days. It was free. And we had an issue track for talking about issues. And then we had a technology thing for sort of learning more of the nitty gritty of stuff. And it was amazing. And we had snacks and then we had a party after. We had a happy hour. It was perfect. So I really hope that we get to do that again. I mean, we kind of, it was just me and April organizing this. We kind of tied it together with dental floss and chewing gum. But it worked and people seemed really excited about it. And what I was most pleased by Digital Rights and Libraries was that, it was not at all like, oh, all these like luminary experts from these non-library organizations talking at librarians, but it was really a conversation between us. And we tried to give equal time to folks from our profession as we did from these other professions. And like, I think we were really successful at that. And I think that that's the sort of thing that I want my professional development to be. And I'd never seen that before. So we just decided to make it up ourselves.
That's great. I'm trying to imagine now where you're going to have it in Orlando. I don't know if we're in Disney World has this.
No, I support the Black Caucus's boycott of Orlando, and not just because I hate Orlando anyway, but because, you know, I think that these are the sorts of things that ALA, first of all, we should support our, the interest groups who have the greatest interest in these things. So Black Caucus is absolutely right to say that, you know, Trayvon Martin's death and the Stand Your Ground laws are an absolute injustice, and that we as librarians should not be going to Orlando, to a place that sanctions this sort of thing. And also, it's Orlando. Like, ew. Not going there.
I went to the conference there when it was there last time, whatever, 2004 or something. Yeah, and that July in Orlando is not a good is not comfortable.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. I mean, but beyond that, it's like,
yeah, no, yeah, I know.
So, you know.
But even physically discomforting. So.
No, totally right. All the reasons. Why would anyone want to go there?
So I do want to talk about your big projects. The first one I want to talk about is the Library Digital Privacy Pledge. Can you talk about what that is and how you worked with Eric Hellman and some other people about that?
Yeah. So Eric Hellman and I are at the helm of it, but it represents work from a number of different groups, including the LIDA Patron Privacy Interest Group. Basically what it is, we have this pledge for libraries, for vendors, for membership organizations to agree to put their services, their web services on HTTPS by a certain time. And HTTPS, basically, this is the secure protocol for accessing websites. So you've got HTTP, which is plain text, HTTPS, which sends your traffic out to between you and that website. It sends it using encryption, which means that it can't be eavesdropped by anyone. It can't be tampered with. And this is super important for libraries, because if we use HTTP on our websites and someone is using a packet analyzer, which is trivially easy to do, actually it's something that Gary Price demonstrated at Digital Rights and Libraries. Someone using a packet analyzer can see exactly what is being searched for on our site. So I can see sometimes the unencrypted login cookies of a patron, which means like if they logged in with their library card and password, I can see that information. I can see, excuse me, what books they looked for. I can see, you know, a whole host of personal information. And if we really care about reader privacy, we should be appalled by this. So this pledge is getting the library community to agree to create a new professional standard for ourselves, keeping in line with the professional standard that the technology industry has been using for a while, and that we can be leaders on this, that very much of the web is unencrypted. And I think that librarians and libraries and all the organizations that serve us can take a big stand and say, this is an unacceptable part of the web infrastructure and we can do better. One thing that we're working with, too, is this amazing initiative called Let's Encrypt, which is a partnership of EFF, Mozilla, and a few other organizations where they're making a free, open, and automated certificate authority. So the governing bodies that hand out the security certificates that you would install on your web server to make them use strong encryption, EFF and Mozilla are and these other groups are creating their own that's going to be totally free, and it will help to automate the renewal process of these certificates, and it's going to remove some of the technical barriers to HTTPS implementation. So we're hoping that because of this launch, it's going to be a thing that will catalyze libraries into joining on and encrypting their websites.
It's kind of assumed as some people who don't do it sometimes is that they maybe don't have the staff to do it, or they don't have the expertise to do it. But yeah, it's nice that the Let's Encrypt thing is making it much easier to implement.
Totally. Another thing that we're offering too is that, you know, whether or not folks decide to use Let's Encrypt or whether they use one of the, there are other free certs you can get, like Start SSL, I think, is a free one. And even for most library websites, the cost would not really be prohibitive. Like, you know, depending on the kind of services you have, you know, it might be like under $100 a year, depending. But we have some volunteer technologists who are working with us who are on hand for those libraries who don't have a technical person in-house to help them with this. We may be able to offer them some direct technical support to get this stuff going. So,
have you gotten good feedback on this so far? Have you gotten anybody signing the pledge, things like that?
Oh yeah, we've got a whole bunch of charter signatories. I don't know that I can make them public yet, so I don't want to name them. But like at least one major vendor and several like big deal library rock star people. So when we Eric and I really just the thing I'm working on with DHS is sort of bottlenecked some of my work for me. But Eric has been really great at promoting it, and I just put it up on the Library Freedom Project site, and we will be doing some more promotional stuff around that pretty soon. Sorry that I keep yawning. I'm totally not tired. The Let's Encrypt schedule has been pushed back, so like that kind of works for us too, because you know we needed some time. But yeah, we are going to start promoting it pretty heavily, I think, a little bit later on in the fall.
Your other big project, and this is the one that we have to say that we're recording this a little earlier than it's going to come out, and so things are going to be a little different. We'll include links in the show notes to anything that brings the story up to date. But just get the Tor Relay project. Can you, first of all, just tell listeners who don't know, what is Tor and what are relays?
Yeah, so Tor is a piece of software that people can use to help protect their privacy and obscure some of the personally identifiable information about themselves when they use the web. More specifically, most people use Tor in the form of Tor browser, which is a web browser that when you connect to it, the IP address that goes out to the public internet is not the same one that you started with. So you get an IP address that might be in France or might be in Germany or something like that. And this makes it so that government surveillance, corporate surveillance, your internet service provider, that, you know, you're obscuring your real location from them. It also does a number of other things, like it makes a lot of the stuff that you put on the web ephemeral, like it doesn't keep your browsing history and all that sort of stuff. And when you use Tor with HTTPS, like if you use HTTPS websites and Tor, you can obscure your location. You can encrypt the data that you send between sites. And it offers you a huge measure of protection from different kinds of surveillance.
And so, to be clear for listeners, this is available for Windows, OS X, kind of everything.
Yeah, it's available for everything. It's free and open source software. You can get it from torproject.org, T-O-R, Tor. I wrote about it for Reference and User Services Quarterly's Accidental Technologist column, which I explain a lot of the kind of ideological and technical stuff. But essentially, since the internet is, you know, a very effective spying tool now, Tor is one of a host of different pieces of software that can really help us protect our privacy. And it's one of the most effective. So Tor operates, it bounces your it bounces traffic between a network of a series of relays, right? It creates a circuit, and the relays for each user, it bounces it over three relays. So these relays are run by volunteers all over the world, and each time it goes to another relay, it's another layer of encryption between you and the public internet knowing your real IP address. The relays are just computers that are set up to run as a Tor relay. And if we have more relays, we will have more network strength and speed for Tor and for Tor users worldwide. And one of the amazing things about Tor is that because it is a global effort, it's, you know, by using Tor browser and running Tor relays, we can not only support our own privacy, but we can support global internet freedom for people all over the world, not just their privacy, but fighting censorship. Quick example, if you live in a country, an internet repressive country like Iran or China, and you, during the Arab Spring, for example, a lot of websites like Twitter and Facebook were blocked in certain countries, in Egypt. And by using Tor, people in those countries can still get to Twitter and Facebook, and they can organize, and they can, you know, participate in direct action without having those sites censored from them. So it's an amazing anti-censorship tool. And, you know, I think for libraries to run these relays, we're supporting our values at home and also globally. So I introduced this project with Tor Project, who are one of my partners with LFP, to get libraries to run the exit relays in particular. Running any of the relays is good. There are middle relays, which are the ones, they basically exactly as they sound. It's like the point that bounces the traffic in the center. There are also bridges, which are unpublished relays for people who live in censored countries. All Tor relays are public. And then what happens sometimes is like China might block the list of all the public relays. So then you have this like secret bridge relay. So you can run those too. Also very good. But the really necessary ones are the exit relays, because the exit relay is the only identifiable one on the circuit. So you are assuming some responsibility, I guess, in a sense, of your relay being identifiable. So it's harder for an individual to run one of these, because it might be harder, even if you make it really clear that this is an exit relay. If some malicious traffic exits through your relay and you're an individual, it might be difficult to convince law enforcement that that traffic is not your own, which is why many institutions run these relays, because then it is quite easy, because you can say, we provide public internet services for a number of people, and we have all kinds of traffic leaving our network. This is not our traffic. Good day to you, sir. And actually, Boing Boing, the website Boing Boing, recently got, they run an exit relay. They recently got a letter from the FBI inquiring about some of their traffic, and their legal team sent a letter just like that. They said, this is an exit relay. This is how this functions. We don't know anything about where this traffic originated from. We keep no logs. We can't help you. Support Tor, basically. So we started this project, you know, and it just seemed to make so much sense, like for the ideology of libraries, from what we can support in the network technically, especially since so many of our libraries are moving to fiber internet and getting really high speeds. It's the amount of bandwidth you have to devote to the network is really not all that much. And the more you have, the more you can donate without your patrons ever seeing any effect in, you know, they're not going to miss that bandwidth, essentially. So we set this all up. We had a pilot library, Kilton Library in Lebanon, New Hampshire. And we chose Kilton because LFP had already had a relationship with them. We'd been there a number of times, done some trainings, done some more advanced stuff for their staff. And the IT librarian there, Chuck McAndrew, is awesome. And like is one of these librarians who's so gung-ho about library tech privacy. He set up all of his public computers and his staff computers on different GNU Linux distributions, which is incredible since most of us are on Windows. And Windows is kind of an appalling spying machine. GNU Linux is free and open source software. It fits more firmly with library values of transparency and privacy and community and all these things. So Chuck, we knew he was the right guy for helping us with this, and Kilton was the right location. So we set this up over the summer, and we got an amazing amount of public support. Our communities were really excited about it. Everybody kind of saw that this was like a great opportunity to wed like the theoretical ideals of librarianship with some really practical needs for the internet infrastructure. And we got written up in Ars Technica and Motherboard and a few other places. So we were pretty happy about it. And then a few weeks later, Chuck got in touch with us and said, hey, the Department of Homeland Security contacted our police, and our police contacted us. And essentially what happened was they introduced some FUD, some fear, uncertainty, and doubt, into the project. They suggested that Tor's use is primarily for criminal activity. I don't believe they had any evidence to support this claim, because I've never seen any concrete evidence that supports that. And basically they frightened the library stakeholders, not unreasonably, and the relay was shut down. So Library Freedom Project and Tor Project responded with an open letter signed by a number of our supporters in the library and software and privacy communities. Electronic Frontier Foundation signed it, Free Software Foundation, Cory Doctorow, a whole bunch of other luminaries. And then we set up this petition on EFF's site to help support Tor, intellectual freedom in libraries, and condemn the fear-mongering tactics of the DHS. And then Julia Angwin from ProPublica wrote about what happened too. When we've gotten, like, I thought the support we got for the relay initially was amazing. Like, this is like, I can't keep up with all the people who are writing to us saying that they want to help. The library has gotten dozens of emails saying, please keep your relay up, like, support internet freedom. We love you. This is kind of the best thing that could have happened, honestly, because, you know, it's a great opportunity in the library world to talk about, like, you know, the overreach of intelligence agencies, how they attempt to stifle or silence free speech and protected free speech activities, how we can respond and resist within our communities, and how much support we have when we do this. So where we are right now, on September 14th, is that tomorrow is the Lebanon Libraries board meeting. Lebanon is the Kilton is one branch in Lebanon Libraries. And Nima, my partner in this, who is involved with Library Freedom Project and also is involved with Tor Project, he and I will go to this meeting with Devin Chafee from the ACLU of New Hampshire. We will speak briefly about the merits of Tor, and then we're going to hear from the community. And I'm really excited about that, because we've heard from so many people who are coming to this board meeting with us. Many of them have contacted the library already and written support letters and all this. And they're such a diverse group. I mean, some of them are like cool, like live free or die, Free State, New Hampshire types. Some of them are computer scientists who live in the area. Some of them are other librarians. Some of them are folks from Dartmouth, because the board is made up of a lot of people from Dartmouth. And I'm feeling really optimistic about it. So we'll find out what the community thinks, and then we'll let the board make the decision about whether or not to keep the relay up. And to be honest, I mean, of course I want to win this. I want to see the relay come back up. But we support the library no matter what happens. And we think that this has been such an amazing opportunity for us. It's already spawned like 15 exit relays that people put up in solidarity. A lot of other libraries have contacted us asking if they can be considered either next or as a replacement pilot. The only reason we had one going was because we needed this pilot, right? Like, we have all these other libraries who want to do this, but we weren't ready for the beta stage of the project yet. So I think that it is going to be successful, like, kind of no matter what happens. And we certainly aren't backing down. And now we when we originally got started on the project, the things that we were kind of prepared for happening, like maybe you'll get a letter from the FBI, you know, with some malicious traffic, or maybe you'll probably get a DMCA takedown notice, and libraries are protected by some of the safe harbor provisions around those. This was not in our threat model. DHS taking a preemptive strike against the free speech of this library and their community was not something we planned for, but now we know. And now we are ready for it if they try to pull this kind of shenanigans again. And we also know that our community has roundly rejected that kind of intelligence agency bullying. We're pretty much ready for the next step, whatever it is.
So for libraries that are considering doing this, but they are maybe in more conservative areas that maybe wouldn't be as supportive of this, how do you answer that question that you kind of brought up, when, because you're going to get it, you know, aren't you facilitating criminal activity? How do you answer that? Because, I mean, I know you have an answer to that.
Sure. So, I mean, think of Tor as a tool. It's just like any other tool. It can be used for good and it can be used for bad. If you think of it as an essential piece of internet infrastructure, first of all, the clear web is filled with criminal activity, and we don't talk about banning that. Some people use roads to drive to work. Some people use roads to drive drunk. That is not a good argument for banning roads. You know, we have to take the good with the bad, and we have to let I think traditional police work in law enforcement, you know, can be effective at fighting the criminal elements, but blocking the use of the tool itself is dangerous misinformation and disinformation, and it is detrimental to a free society. Now, the other thing that I want to say about specifically about digital criminal activities is that if you ban Tor, if you get rid of it entirely, you're not going to get rid of criminal activity. That's the thing about criminals. They have many options before them. They're quite literally willing to break the law to get what they want. Now, the people who use Tor because they need it for privacy, they need to protect their right to free expression, they are living in repressive countries or in difficult situations. Some user groups that come to mind that use Tor include journalists who are traveling in potentially dangerous places. Domestic violence survivors use Tor a lot because their abusers want to find out their location information. Business people use Tor to help protect their trade secrets. Children use Tor to help protect themselves online. You know, there are endless use cases of different people who have a great need for privacy. And if you ban Tor, none of those people will get privacy. The criminals will still have a lot of options because they're willing to break the law. But the people who use it because this is the best resource they have and another one doesn't exist, all of those people will suffer. The net harm will be really great. And, you know, for those people, especially in really conservative places, when I talk to those places, not just, you know, setting up the sort of diverse ways that Tor is used and how it's a tool among many others, but I really like to make it personal for them. Like I said, you know, business people use Tor. The military uses Tor. Actually, Tor began as a military research project. The onion routing was developed by the U.S. Navy. The U.S. State Department underwrites Tor because they see it as an essential piece of infrastructure that helps people in repressive countries. So, you know, it's not like this radical fringe thing. It's something that everyone uses and everyone can use, and it absolutely needs to be protected, especially given how the internet is going and how easy it is for people to be surveilled.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting that there's this sort of dichotomy of the different government agencies, that some of them support this and some of them are completely against it and trying to shut it down. And it just shows different. The government isn't just one big thing.
So. Well, sure. Absolutely. And I think that is it's a really compelling thing, right? It's like the left hand doesn't know what the right is doing. It seems a bit schizophrenic to me. And I think what it really betrays is a deep technical misunderstanding about how Tor works at the DHS. And I think that one thing that we can do as librarians, as public civil servants, we can use Tor, we can promote it in our libraries, and we can help those people in our communities, like law enforcement, like our library boards, like maybe the people who might have a little bit more conservative approach to this, we can help them understand what it's really for. You know, when the internet came out, people said the same stuff about it. People said, this is going to be used by criminals. This is just going to be used for malicious things. And, you know, now, you know, 30 years in, we know that that is true, but it's not at all the whole truth. And it absolutely is not representative of, like, most of what is on the internet. The internet is a diverse place. And Tor is just another tool that does the same kind of thing.
You can get your cat pictures just as well with Tor as anything else.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Absolutely.
So kind of long term, is the on Library Freedom Project, is the goal right now just to sort of expand what you're currently doing? Do you have anything else you want to talk about project wise that you have plans for, or is it right now is just kind of expansion of current projects?
Yeah. So the Tor exit thing is actually part of a bigger project that Nima and I are working on that we're calling Libre Libraries right now. Libre being, you know, free as in freedom, Libre. We call it that because of the free and open source software uses that term to mean like software that respects your freedom. You can use, modify, change the source code if you want to. Libre Libraries, what we're hoping to do with that is to get folks to run Tor exits, to get them to help us support free and open source software by offering mirrors, it's another way to download the software, which is useful, again, in countries with a lot of censorship. If you mirror the software download somewhere else, the blocked site, you know, if you block torproject.org, but you also have a mirror of Tor browser at like tor.ourlibrary.org, then people who are not able to access it on the original site can still download it. So we want libraries to host these mirrors. We also want them to host free software seed boxes where they would help seed the software for downloads, again, like making it available in more places and strengthening the speed of the downloads. And you know, I think sort of more generally, the Libre Libraries project is one to help libraries get out of our kind of provincial thinking and think about how we might be able, and I don't mean that as an insult, I mean that quite literally, that we think about our specific geographic areas, but how can we support global internet freedom in ways that doesn't actually tax our own resources, because I know we have our taxpayers to think about, uses resources that we already have that wouldn't have any effect on our patrons if we use them for something else, and also that can kind of demonstrate our values to the whole world in a practical way. So that's one thing that we're working on. Obviously, the Library Digital Privacy Pledge is another one. You know, we're still visiting libraries all over the place. You know, in October, we'll be, you know, we're always all over Massachusetts. We're going to Cincinnati, to Charlotte, North Carolina, to Chapel Hill, to Lake Placid, New York, to Manchester, New Hampshire, and then also Providence, Rhode Island. And that's just October. And the rest of the year, we're going like a little further afield, LA and Salt Lake City and Oklahoma City. So many different libraries, as many as we can reasonably get to. We're looking for more funding to expand the project to really like focus on the train the trainer thing for those librarians who have shown themselves to be like, to want to be more involved with the project. So like, cloning more of me, I guess. So yeah, we have a lot of ambitious stuff ahead of us, but we have so much amazing support in the library community and in the other communities we're involved in. It's going to be a really exciting next year for us.
Yeah, and then so yeah, you can get a grant for the Clone Allison Fund.
Yeah, absolutely.
Can you tell the listeners where they can go to find out more about you and the Library Freedom Project?
Yeah, they can go to libraryfreedomproject.org, and that is on HTTPS. So if you type it in, it will go right to HTTPS by default. Libraryfreedomproject.org, They can certainly feel free to email me. My contact info is on my website, but I'll say it here too. It's Allison, A-L-I-S-O-N, at libraryfreedomproject.org. They can also follow us on Twitter, at Library Freedom at Library Freedom is like the Library Freedom Project handle. And then at Flex Libris, F-L-E-X-L-I-B-R-I-S is me. And most of our activities are there. And you can kind of, sometimes when we go to places, we'll like take pictures of the library and do that kind of fun, cute stuff. So you can follow along as if you're on our Library Freedom Tour.
Awesome. Thank you so much for being on the show, Allison, and good luck with everything in the future. And as I said, as we said earlier, we will post any kind of updates to the tour project thing in the show notes. So check that out if you haven't already heard the story about that. So.
Yeah, well, I hope that it, I hope, but by the time this goes up, that you will have heard it, because I hope it's giant news. But I'll make sure you have everything you need to post it anyway. So thank you so much for having me, Steve.
All right, bye-bye.
Awesome, bye.
If you'd like to learn more about the show or listen to past episodes, you can visit circulatingideas.com or follow us on Twitter at CircIdeas. We're also on Tumblr at circulatingideas.tumblr.com, or you can like us on Facebook at facebook.com/circulatingideas. If you have comments, questions, or suggestions for future interviews, you can drop us a line at mail@circulatingideas.com. Music is by Pamela Klicka. Thank you for listening, and keep circulating the ideas. I've contacted a couple of people, and they're like, they come up on the webcam, and I was like, no, we're not doing that. So I always try to warn everybody now. I was like, just don't even worry about it. So
I, you know, fortunately have listened to other Circulating Ideas podcasts, so I knew that, which means I'm still in my pajamas.